Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
With all due respect, Danny, you know, Danny's a friend. He's a weak link.
Oh my goodness.
He's a weak link in this match. Look, I think that Anish, you know, he might ruin it himself, but Danny is a weak link for sure. It's all going very downhill for my good friend Anish Giri, AG as he calls himself. Ding was off from the start. I felt it after I was the first player to play him.
Yeah.
I felt it after three moves.
Welcome back, everybody, to another C-Squared podcast episode. Fabi, you just got back to the States after a pretty adventurous trip in Europe. You were in Germany playing the Freestyle Chess GOAT Challenge, Chess 960 Fischer Random, however you want to call it. But overall, it looked like a very fun event. Tell us a bit about your experience with the Freestyle GOAT Chess Challenge, Episode 1.
Yeah, you know what's funny? Before we get into that, like the last time we spoke, I was in Germany already.
Yeah.
And like 5 minutes after we finished talking, I started to feel like really, really bad.
Really?
I was like, okay, this will pass. And I went to get dinner and I was like, I can't possibly have dinner. It's just so bad. And then I came back to my room and I just like realized I have food poisoning, which passed rather quickly, luckily.
You got food poisoning in Germany?
Yeah, I got food poisoning somehow.
What did you eat?
I think it was, to be honest, I don't know. I think it was maybe salmonella from eggs.
From what I know, salmonella is pretty bad. Like, it actually bad reads you.
Yeah, it was like a day that I was like feeling really bad, and then I threw up and I suddenly started to feel so much better. It was just like hours I was waiting for, and then suddenly I feel so much better. But I was still drained after that for a few days. And rather unluckily, I was playing this Champions Chess Tour like the day after. So it was a pretty disastrous. I was like, I couldn't even focus on the moves. I was like, I'll just move it on autopilot, not even looking at what I'm doing. And then I went to, things got better after that. I went to this place near Hamburg for the freestyle chess, they called it, that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Chess GOAT Challenge, Freestyle Chess GOAT Challenge.
Yeah, I still feel like calling it Fischer Random. But I understand, okay, they want to rebrand it. Like the St. Louis Chess Club also wanted to rebrand it. They called it Chess 9LX, right? People are always trying to rebrand Fischer Random as something else, but I still would prefer to call it Fischer Random, personally. But if they want to call it Freestyle Chess, I'll call it Freestyle Chess their tournament.
Yes, I think you said something quite smart about it. Who is Fischer and why is he random? I guess that's the point. They just want to brand it for newcomers in the chess world, for the new generation.
I think that's the reason that the guy gave, like, he explained that he just wanted to give a clean kind of name that is very intuitive for it, which it's true. Freestyle is sort of intuitive for the newcomer. It's like you're mixing up the pieces. It's a bit freestyle, right? You have no crutch in the opening, no opening theory to rely on.
I like the freestyle part of it. Yes. I don't understand the GOAT part of it. I guess it has something to do with, I don't know, Magnus being involved and him considering Magnus the GOAT or something like that. But what was quite interesting was that
common misconception. It had nothing to do with Magnus.
Okay.
We were on a goat farm. It was, people don't know, but it was actually a goat farm. And there were just goats everywhere. It had nothing to do with.
Okay, so the guy is just into goats.
No, I'm kidding.
This
It was
young guy.
no, it was well, he's not a young, not a young guy.
No, Jan, that's his name, right?
Oh, Jan, yeah. His
Jan
name is
Bittner,
Jan
or
Bittner. Yeah, of course, it was supposed to be like greatest of all time, so it's branded around Magnus, who it's arguable, like we can argue who the greatest of all time is. Of course, some people will say Gary. Magnus even said Gary. Some people will say Magnus. Some people might even say someone else, although usually the discussion revolves around those two
Yeah,
players.
Fisher, maybe.
Yeah, some people might say Fischer, or some people even might say like Lasker. I don't know. I mean, it's some people have weird ideas. For me, it's pretty clearly between Gary and Magnus, with maybe a slight edge to Gary because his dominance, we just it's probably not possible anymore. But he would go years without even not without not winning a tournament. So he would go years without getting second place even once. It's just impossible these days, but somehow he was so far ahead. So no matter how great Magnus is, it's still difficult to beat that. You know, it's a lot. But of course, they are both in their own ways have some claim to the greatest of all time title, we can definitely say. And yeah, it was a great tournament. It really was a great tournament. I'm not just saying that. But it's the organization was really excellent, pretty much the best I've seen in terms of organization, you know.
And that's actually how it looked like from a spectator's point of view as well. It definitely felt like it's geared towards making the players feel very welcomed and basically feel like superstars. Like, okay, there's an element of trying to commercialize chess and freestyle chess, however you want to call it, and the broadcast. They were trying to commercialize the broadcast as well. That was pretty obvious, you know, with the money, with the jacks and kings and whatnot, with the jackets. I really like the jackets, actually. I didn't realize that that's going to be an element of it, but I really like the jackets aspect of it. What was the most, let's say, important factor in your opinion as a player that really made it feel like, okay, yes, I'm valued here. I feel like a superstar.
Well, the thing is that we were staying at his own resort, which is usually a place where they host, let's say, like summits or I don't know, a gathering of important people, politicians or celebrities or whatever. So, it's basically it was very easy for him to make it as comfortable as possible for the players because he controlled the environment. So we felt absolutely. I mean, I can't speak for everyone 100%, but I can speak for myself, and I think probably other players would agree with the sentiment generally that we felt pretty much at home and very t well taken care of, and it was quite luxurious. The resort, the food, the playing conditions, everything was pretty well thought out. I think that because it was their first time, definitely some format questions, definitely some things could be improved with the format. And the players also, I think, mostly would agree with that the 2-day preliminary rapid for basically not much, like we didn't play for much, was a bit unusual. And then
But
like five players,
given the
sorry.
format, given it being chess, freestyle chess, or chess 9LX, or chess 960, however you want to call it, given that, didn't you feel that those 2 extra days for playing for pretty much sitting in the tournament and not much, would you say that helped you ease into the new format?
Okay, but let's look at it. Yeah, sure, you could say that it's sort of easing into the format, but it's also 2 days. It's not like 1 day of blitz. It's two full days of rapid, 6 hours a day. 1 day we played. That's quite a lot. It's not like entire. And of course, you still want to play well. You
It's
don't want to give zero
competition.
effort. Yeah. So it is a bit energy draining. And then at the end, let's say Noderbeck wins, and then he feels like, what did I really gain out of winning? Okay, he played Ding, so he can say, yeah, this was in this time when Ding was not in shape, probably the match that he would be happiest to play, that he would play rather play Ding than someone else. Well, maybe I'm not 100% sure, but maybe that's how he felt. But if you look at the rest of it, like normally the higher up you get, the more advantageous it should be. Mm-hmm. But Alireza got fourth, and he plays Magnus, who got fifth place.
Yeah.
And that is objectively a worse pairing. And we can just say there's nothing to discuss who you're more comfortable against. It's worse. It's more difficult to play Magnus than it is to play, for example, Keimer.
Yes.
And let's say Levon played Keimer, getting seventh place. So it was better to get fourth place or seventh place. Well, objectively, we have to say that it's better to get seventh place, which is just strange.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you can say, yeah, this happened because Magnus underperformed, and who can predict that?
Mm-hmm.
But then it's basically going to be like you have to look around and try to figure out who you want to play. Like in the last game against Levon, I was actually thinking about this because I was playing the game. At some point, I realized I'm kind of in control of this game. And I was thinking, well, if I win, I get third,
mm-hmm.
for sure.
Mm-hmm.
If I draw, I probably get fourth. And I'm looking and I'm seeing, okay, Magnus is probably getting fifth because he seemed to be losing against Noderbeck at that time. And of course, like no matter what, I would have still tried to win the game because it's just like on principle, I'm going to try to win the game. But I was having these thoughts during the game, like, it's weird if I win and then I get a harder pairing than if I drew, right? I mean, this doesn't really add up logically. But in the end, it was in fact true that I won. I got third place. But there was some scenario where, let's say I draw, I get fifth place, and then I win, I get fourth place. And something like this, where it's actually better to draw than to win. And I think my third place in the Rapid ended up being quite a good pairing. But of course, I think that it should matter more. Like, you should get some advantage for winning. Like, Noderbeck should have had some advantage, not just that he plays Ding.
Maybe the way they do it with the qualification for the play-in during the Champions Chess Tour, where you actually get to choose if you choose who you want to play, for example, in the
I thought about this. But this also has a big... This means that fourth place is, again, very bad.
Mm-hmm.
Because this doesn't give fourth place a choice. You would think that the first four players choose, but what happens is only the first three choose.
Correct.
So the first one chooses. Let's say it's Noderbeck. Let's say he decides to play Ding. Second one chooses. It's Keimer. Let's say he decides that he wants to play Gukesh, for example. Then I'm third. Mm-hmm. I decide that I want to play Levon.
Mm-hmm.
Fourth gets Magnus.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah.
Fourth doesn't have a choice. So what is the choice? Like, again, the fourth place person is going to automatically get the hardest opponent from the remaining players.
So in this format, oh yes, and what you're saying is basically it's, I guess fourth and fifth place doesn't really change much. If you're finishing in fourth or fifth place, doesn't really change much.
Well, it does. I mean, because you'll get four, like the...
So you reward the top three in that format.
Yeah, but actually fifth place might be better because then, like, let's say if an underdog gets in the top three, then you could get picked by an underdog. But in fourth, you're automatic. I can give you another example, which I was talking to Vincent about this stuff. I was talking to a bunch of the players about this, but Vincent in particular gave an example from his recent Champions Chess Tour. And then he just got Wesley because he had to pick, and Wesley was the only one there. So Wesley was in the bottom half, so he gets basically the hardest opponent out of the potential picks. And then he gave me an example. He was like, well, to qualify for Division One, because of this format, I had to beat Wesley, and then I had to beat Alireza, and I had to also win a match before that. So it's not like it's impossible to do this, but it is enormously difficult just to qualify for Division One because this system gave him... Of course, always someone will be unhappy with any system. There will be someone who gets left out, someone who gets an advantageous spot. But I think if we can't find the perfect system, we might as well not waste 2 days playing Rapid Chess to decide this imperfect system, right?
Yeah.
We can play one day of Blitz. That's what I was suggesting.
That's basically what they do in Norway, right?
Yeah, Norway and same chess. Thing.
Yeah.
But instead of 2 days of Rapid, you play 1 day of Blitz. It's a bit... because we're not like playing for money. We're not playing for rating. We're not playing... It ends up being a little bit for nothing, you could say, for the spectators, I guess, but
okay, you could say that you're not playing for nothing right now, but give it a few more years and, you know, just like Rapid and Blitz weren't as weighted, 5-10 years ago. Nowadays, Rapid and Blitz is extremely important. maybe on par with classical chess. Give it 5 to 10 years. You have this guy, you know, organizing his tour. Maybe some other organizers are going to pop on the scene. Maybe FIDE is going to get involved. They're going to give the reins to the Chess 960 or like Freestyle Chess World Championship. There were some discussions on Reddit that they might offer the World Championship to Jan Bittner. And suddenly Chess 960, Freestyle Chess, however you want to call it, becomes a thing and becomes a very important thing of the chess ecosystem. So I don't know.
I agree, but I think that's we can't speak about hypotheticals.
Right.
I mean, I'm just talking in the current moment. If things get rated and then, of course, things are meaningful and these rapid games will mean a lot, sure. But at the moment, there's no rating, no prizes for these rapid games. The seeding didn't end up being like super consistent who you were playing against based on your seeding. So I felt like this was a slight flaw in the system.
Right, right. No, I tend to agree with that. I think there is a couple of reasons why they did that. For once, I think it just has a practical purpose so that the spectators, the commentators and the players get used to the format. I think that's quite important. And after that, obviously, you know, they probably expected some people to do better and to be able to choose better in a different way. It didn't work out this time, but I mean, yeah, sure. You spend a couple of extra days, but I don't think it's a huge drawback, you know. And probably they had a certain number of days in mind that they wanted to make the tournament happen in. So
sure, but you can tweak around the format all you want. You can do double elimination. You can make it a bit longer if you want, but you can eliminate these. Like, I don't think we should have non-competitive, like really not super competitive days.
I guess that's your point. Yeah, yeah.
A few players were playing a bit loose. Like, I thought Levon, I mean, he was obviously in good shape at some point in the tournament, but he's obviously playing loose in this rapid and maybe doesn't care too much about the result.
Okay.
Ding was off from the start. I felt it after I was the first player to play him.
Yeah.
I felt it after 3 moves.
Really, huh? What gave
it away? Yeah, I felt it after 3 moves. I'm like, this something's off.
What gave it away?
Okay, I'll tell you. So let me get my first game against him. I'll just because it's obviously Fischer random, so I already don't remember some of the details.
The starting position.
Yeah, the starting position I actually don't remember. But so there was a sort of theme in this position, which was that we had the rook on h1, king on g1, rook on f1, and there was a bishop on a8, so the bishop is bearing down on g2, which means that the g2 pawn is a weakness because it's not defended by any pieces rather than the king, and also can't be defended by any pieces rather than the king. So very often you'll have to block with the pawn, like f3. But there are tactical ideas like bishop takes g2, and then after the king comes out, then there's a queen coming to check, and the king can't escape because f1 and h1 are both covered, and it's not like a knight that can jump to g3, right? So the king will have to run to the center. And on move 3, he plays a move like I'm attacking this pawn with my bishop, opening up the idea of bishop takes g2, and he plays like some move on the other side of the board, like b3, b4, within seconds. And then I was like, what is this? He's allowing me to take on g2, and he couldn't have possibly calculated everything because his king is running to the center. And I spent some time calculating it, and I decided not to go for it because it looked like a mess, which is true. It was a mess. And maybe also objectively, I should have gone for it because the position, I kind of underestimated the danger that I'm in.
Yeah.
But just to allow that shows that something is off. Just the fact that he's allowing bishop g2, because that means he didn't see it. And it's a very, like, it's just like basic tactics, and you have 25 minutes. Mm-hmm. So, like, why are you rushing on the first 3 moves in a completely unknown position?
Yeah.
And then the rest of the game kind of demonstrated that he was not in form because he didn't play very well, to be honest.
I mean, the rest of the tournament was pretty disastrous for Ding, yeah? Actually, disastrous for Ding. I think he scored, 1.5 out of 13 games?
Yeah, if we're not counting the round robin, he basically lost all his games. But we can say, okay, round robin, maybe he stopped caring at some point. But then also he did lose all his matches as well.
Yeah, no, it was pretty rough. And I mean, I remember that moment when he gave up a piece long into the end game, in one move, basically. That's just like a 1500 mistake that you do in classical.
You mean against me?
Was that against you when he played Bishop
B5? When he blundered Rook E3?
Yes, Bishop B5, Rook E3.
Yeah, that was against
me. Yeah, absolutely crazy. But that's something that I've noticed when I played chess, 960 freestyle chess before as well. You get used to thinking differently than you generally think during a chess game. Did that happen to you as well? Did you have difficulties readjusting? Let's say once the position normalizes, did you have difficulties readjusting to, you know, seeing the usual patterns that you usually see in a chess game?
I mean, there's some challenges there. It's hard to say, you know, because we were playing very complex positions. Of course, we made many mistakes, and you can't always know why you're making these mistakes.
Right.
So I can't say it was because I wasn't used to typical patterns. Like, I made mistakes. Sure, some of the mistakes were because of that. Some of the mistakes were just like ordinary chess mistakes. I found it overall very interesting. Like, if I look back on even, first of all, the rapid, I feel like in the rapid, it was up and down, but overall was reasonably happy with my play. I was definitely like on the better side of most games. And okay, I lost a bad game to Vincent. Well, he played well. I didn't play too well. I was actually very close to beating Noderbeck. I was like outplaying him at some point, and then he made a draw. And up and down game against Magnus, was very lucky to survive, I have to say. Mm-hmm. But also outplayed him at some moment. And okay, I beat Levon in the last round, beat Kukesh in a pretty good game. So yeah, overall, I was happy with that. Then the matches started. I played Gukesh first. I thought I'm definitely should be a favorite.
Yeah.
But of course he is tough. And the first game was the toughest part because I was much worse losing at some moment, but there was, I don't know when it happened. It was a classical game, right? So normally people keep control, but more or less right when his advantage was at its greatest, he suddenly did some very strange things. First of all, King F8. Now, King F8 didn't even come to mind. And yeah, when he played it, I was thinking A6. Uh-huh. But suddenly he plays King F8. And I'm like, I understand in the vacuum, kind of he's trying to avoid some Rook D1, Rook D5 ideas. So the king's getting out of the way of a pin. But it's such a short position. You don't expend a tempo on this. Like, you go for concrete stuff. I mean, And then it just fell apart. Like, at some point he went, you know, from winning to, or even much better, to equal, and then suddenly to losing, and it all fell apart. And then the second game was really clean. I was just winning, and I agreed to a draw because it won me the match.
Yeah.
Then against Levon was an enormously difficult match. Okay, he beat me in a really tough game at the start. I mean, it was a long game. This is one he beat me, and very upsetting because I was like, I was dead, completely dead, I felt. And then from being dead, suddenly, I got very decent chances to draw. Like, very, very decent. And it was surprising that somewhere, like, I'm more or less ready to resign. I have no time, no increment, nothing. Like, I'm certain to lose this game. And then suddenly, I have legitimate chances to survive. And then it doesn't work out. At some point, I messed it up again. And then I came back with a really good game. So that was really, but then I have to play this full rapid tiebreak, which is so up and down.
That was insane. That was insane. Yeah. Finished in the Armageddon. Really, really cool match. And sure, you hanged a couple of rooks in the process. Reddit was going wild about it. Any comments about Reddit going wild? You losing and hanging rooks?
No, I mean, I understand, of course. It's weird. It's weird to make these blunders. Because I was completely in control of, let's say, the first rapid game. Like, I can tell you, at a point when the evaluation was -4.2, according to this engine that I'm looking at, mm-hmm. I have 3 minutes and Lev has 27 seconds. And then from this moment, I lost this game. At, first of all, because I started to mess things up a bit, but mostly because I just put my rook on a defended square. So I should say attacked square. So he was attacking it with his bishop. And yeah, it shouldn't happen. So I don't know why it happened. But then I
this
somehow
is
came back to this.
A prime example of not recognizing patterns because you started in a different form.
I don't know. To be honest, I think that it was like I was getting low on time and starting to feel like I'm messing up the game. I had already started to have that feeling, like once I played Bishop D5 and then he takes on E7, I'm starting to feel like, okay, it's getting very unclear all of a sudden. And you have this like, oh no, I'm doing it. Yeah. I have this totally get this game in the bag and then I'm starting
it.
To mess it up.
Yeah.
And yeah, then Rook B8 was just panic. I went down to like 3 seconds. I saw that he has some ideas, some threats. I wasn't even sure what, but it's like, I have to do something, but everything I do, it might allow a sacrifice on G7. It might allow some tactics. And suddenly I just like looked for the, it was just like an automatic move. Like, I want to play C3. My first thought was I play knight D4, but then suddenly, okay, he plays bishop F2, and then he has like queen B7 ideas. I was like, okay, I need to play C3, so what do I do? I play rook B8. That was the whole thought. And then, okay, he just takes my rook.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, again, I came back. Then I won the first blitz game quite nicely. I think quite a good game under the circumstance, you know, like no serious errors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Maybe not perfect, but no serious errors. And 92.6% accuracy, by the way.
Interesting.
Yeah, interesting.
Very interesting.
And then I just need to draw a blitz game with white. And I was feeling extremely, extremely confident. I was feeling good. I didn't feel nervous, nothing like that. And yeah, the whole game I wasn't worse. Like, maybe I was slightly worse at some one moment during the game. But more or less, I wasn't worse. And then it's heading towards like a draw, but okay, he has to win. And suddenly he's giving me chances. And we get down to seconds. And I feel like, okay, I should be winning at some moment. But I'm mostly trying to find a draw. And I end up just putting my rook on an attack square again. I immediately resign the game.
That's
slash run out of time.
Yeah. And then you guys
the thing
go
is
to
like,
Armageddon, yeah?
Yeah, after rook, like in this game, right before I hung my rook, I was first thinking, okay, I'll play knight a4, and it should be a draw. And then instead of that, then I was like, I don't know, the rook endgame, okay, it's a little bit tricky, it should be a draw, but this was all happening in the span of like half a second. This
right.
was my thought process. I was like, okay, I'll attack the b6 pawn immediately.
Was
and then
that
he'll play like
after you played c7 or before you played c7?
Yeah,
when
of course, if
happening?
I don't play c7, I make my life easier. I just move my rook and then I threaten c7 to queen
right.
the pawn in some moment. So yeah, I hung my rook. I immediately, like as soon as I dropped the rook, I was like, oh, it's hanging. And and then we go to Armageddon, yeah, which was a good game.
That was
like,
a
really
good
game. Good game.
Yeah, yeah, it felt like you had full control with the black pieces.
I mean, 82.8% accuracy, but for Armageddon, that's not bad in Fischer Random, I think.
Yeah, how much time did you guys started with in the Armageddon? What were there any bids? What was the
process? Bid. Actually, the bidding was my suggestion before the tournament.
Okay.
I told him like there was an initial dinner. All these ideas, it's funny, they were like saying they're Magnus' ideas, but they were actually my ideas. Like the first idea was, I was like, let's discuss the position beforehand. So like, and I said, why don't the white players and the black players get into teams and discuss the positions before the games? And then Jan goes to the other table where Magnus is sitting and he's like, do you like this idea? And also asks Ding, and everyone's like, yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's like, well, this was Magnus' idea. I'm like, no, this was my idea. And the other idea was, I was like, okay, in the Champions Chess Tour, they bid. So that's exciting. It adds an extra element. So why don't we bid? And I also suggested that we have an increment after move 60, because first they didn't want to do that. So that's what they adopted, the bidding and the increment after move 60. Because I thought it's ugly if people start to flag, you know, like throwing pieces on the ground and trying to flag with seconds. Like 1 second increment just to avoid this.
Yeah, yeah, no, I'm definitely up for the increment after 60 moves. And also it adds some sort of a race to the finish line element to it, right? Because let's say you have a winning position, but you still are 20 moves away from making it to the 60th move and getting the increment, then you still have a task ahead, which definitely adds another element to the broadcast in general, to the show aspect of the games. So yeah, That was definitely, I would say, one of the most fun, if not the most fun, match to follow without having too much bias. Yeah, Magnus was also on the verge of losing against Alireza, came back and took him the tie breaks, which he won quite comfortably. So that was, let's say, the brink of defeat for Magnus. And he passed that. And then you guys met in the finals. First game, pretty balanced. Second game, the starting position, a lot of people were saying it was extremely imbalanced. How did you feel about the starting position? What happened in that final game?
Yeah, so one thing I want to say is I probably did get, starting positions, there's a bit of luck, right? And mm-hmm. Against Levin, I probably did get a bit lucky mm-hmm. with the starting position. And against Magnus, okay, I won't say this is like, I'm not going to, it's not meant to be an excuse, of course.
No, of course. And I think he said it himself as well. He felt that the position was much better for White. I think he mentioned that in the post-game analysis.
Yeah. I do have to say that he, in both games, he showed excellent understanding of the starting position. So he made this move d6 on move 2 in the first game, which I think was an excellent way of getting a very stable, solid position, which we hadn't really considered before the game. We were thinking like Black will play f5, d5, something like that, and then White tries to open the center. And Magnus correctly, I think, recognized that he can try to build up a center, because after d6 and e5, White can't really comfortably keep the tension. So, okay, that was the first thing. The first game, he was very comfortable. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the second game, he also showed, I think, excellent understanding with being the only player to make the first move g4, which is the best move. By according to engines, it's the best move.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I got a bad position really quickly. The thing is, after
the first move, right? It's already not the best. You're supposed to castle long on move 1.
I think that after g5, the best way to play is h5. And then after g5, g6. And then you sack the b7 pawn. But you get knight c6, and you quickly will attack the b2 pawn.
That's kind of
And
wild.
It's very sharp, but it kind of works out. Yeah. It's difficult to decide on this, but it's probably the best. And if not for that, then the best move is probably knight b6, the second best move. Again, sacking the pawn. And okay, of course, White can take it, but then Black gets a lot of time. But you're sacking material. Like Black plays d5, but you're sacking your queenside pawns on the first move.
Yeah, that's not an easy decision.
So from like the normal moves, I think long castle was not as accurate as knight c6.
Okay.
Which I felt was just like, I didn't want to put my knight on that square. But long castle, I was worried that he plays c4. And then he plays knight c3, and he just attacks me because his rook is eyeing my king on the very first move.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, okay, this is my thought process. I'll play c6. I'll try to build up with d5. Knight goes to c7. And maybe I'll castle short, I was actually thinking. And then I realized that probably castling short, it just takes too much time. And so I kind of pivoted. He castled. I decided to basically try to copy him, like g5, long castle, knight c7. And I was hoping that after e4, that I would be able to like liquidate with e5 in some moment. And I realized that, very importantly, that he has this h4. So he's getting the levers. You could call them levers on the queen side. I don't know, queen side or king side, whatever you want to call it. The queens are on that side, so that's why I call it queen side. So he's always has the option to break the tension, which gives him a lot of, it basically means that I can't really play e5 because he can always take on g5, trade queens, and take on e5, win a pawn. So these things weren't clear to me when I played the first move c6, but he understood the c6 is a mistake. And I actually did have an option after move 3 h4 to play h5. And kind of crazily, tactically, it doesn't lose for Black. Mm. But it's really close to losing and still not very good. And somehow at some moment I did,
you got some chances, right?
I did improve my position. It was never good, but there was some moment when after move 21 queen e5, I had this move knight c4. It was probably my only chance to resist in this entire game.
Mm-hmm.
rather than knight e4. Even the chess.com engine prefers knight e4, but I checked it at some point with a stronger engine, and knight c4, computer says that it's bad, but it's not the end of the world. But practically speaking, of course, black has a nightmare here. Weak king, passed pawn in h5. It's one of those bad positions that's also difficult to play. And then, okay, knight e4, brilliant move, a4, basically winning the game. a4, I didn't spot this move when I played knight e4. I actually thought that my position after knight e4 is improving compared to what it was before. But a4, I was like, I just have no move suddenly. Like, he suggested a6 after the game. But my worry was that after a6, he'll take on e4. And then he'll cement that knight on c5 with a5. Basically, this is what we were discussing after the game. Like, once the knight on c5 gets cemented, that there's probably not much hope. And okay, the way I played it was even just tactically losing. So it was even stupider to play knight c3. But I was already in some kind of desperation. I didn't know what to do. And also no increment. So I felt like I need to kind of keep it a bit fast. But okay, playing fast didn't help in this situation.
Yeah, no. Again, so I would assume, just to close this subject up, from a player's perspective, you felt like everything went smoothly. I have to say, from a spectator's perspective, it looked like a lot of fun. There were a lot of elements that I really liked, pushed the envelope into a more, you might call it commercialized notion or anything of that nature, but it's mostly just you're pushing the envelope towards a more viewer-friendly competition, which I think is something that chess in general needs, and it's something that's going to help players, help chess as a whole. So, no, I think overall the tournament was a success, and I'm very excited to hear that the guy is planning on creating like a whole circuit out of it, which should be interesting. I have to say, the schedule, the chess schedule, is getting extremely, extremely busy. You have this, you have the GCT, you have the CCT, you have so many circuits. You add on top of that the World Championship cycle, and you have a full calendar year with tournaments after tournaments. So
yeah, this is actually an interesting question for chess in the future, for high level chess. So because we've already had like the big players, we've known them for a long time. We have FIDE, of course, always been one of the biggest players, or the biggest player you could say, with the cycle, the infrastructure, the rating system. Basically their tournaments, even if they don't have the money, are
they important have the prestige.
Yeah, intrinsically important, because they work towards the world championship title, which is which has value, which goes beyond money, right?
Sure. Yeah,
it brings money in its own way, and also directly. But even without the money, it would go beyond money. So it's something that you could say, I'm the world chess champion.
Culturally significant, yes. Historically significant, yeah. And it's something
that, like, if you could give any chess player in the world one achievement, that would, then they would say, I want to be the world champion. They wouldn't say, I want to win this tournament or that tournament. They'd say, I want to be the world champion.
Yeah.
So that's why FIDE is always going to be a huge player. And then you have chess.com in the last few years has become a huge player because they have the entire online chess scene. They have, they're probably the most profitable chess company, right? Because they have millions and millions of paying customers. So, and they host a lot of big tournaments, and they attract the best players in the world, including Magnus, including Hikaru, and other very popular, not only popular, but strong, but, you know, both, yeah? They have the popularity, they have the viewership, and all that. So they're another big player. And then the St. Louis Chess Club is the third big player.
And the Grand Chess Tour.
Yeah, they have money that they put into chess, a significant amount. They have infrastructure in terms of a tournament circuit, and they attract the best players in the world.
Yeah.
Even Magnus, who doesn't play all the tournaments, but they do attract him for several events a year. And now we're going to have a fourth big player, it looks like, if he continues with what he said, which, based on our current information, that seems to be the case, that he will continue organizing high-level events with a lot of money, which will certainly attract the best players in the world. And he has the money to spare. I mean, I don't know his net worth, but clearly he has the money to invest and make these very attractive tournaments for players. And Magnus has already shown his commitment to play in one event and probably to play in more. So
not only money, but he seems to have the enthusiasm, right? He seems to be a genuine chess enthusiast. He loves it. He's taking classes, from what I'm understanding. He has the time, he has the resources, and he has the enthusiasm, which I think, again, it's extremely important. And yeah, sure, I mean, Magnus seems to be enjoying it as well. It's a direction that he's trying to push, let's say, chess into. And how do you feel about it? Do you welcome this new addition? How are you going to balance? How are you going to work that balancing act between choosing the tournaments that you want to play in?
Look, in general, I love chess. I really love to play chess. I play tournaments not because they're always like the best idea. Like sometimes it's good to rest, but I can't help myself. I like to play tournaments.
I mean, you played one yesterday.
Maybe yeah. I was just convinced like last minute. It's like, why don't you play this? I was like, okay, I'll play some blitz. To be honest, I'll also probably play on Saturday. There's another tournament. I really like playing chess. Like if I had some people in my house right now to play chess, I would probably be playing some blitz or something else as well. Yeah. Because I just so of course the money makes it very attractive as well, right? Because if you invite me to a tournament and there's also a financial incentive, then of course I'm going to be interested. And yeah, the question is always like, can you actually do all of this at some point? Because there's going to be so many overlapping, intersecting tournaments. The question is, can you play most of them? Can you play all of them? What do you play? What do you not play? Right? Mm-hmm. Which is a privilege to have, to be able to say, I'll play this and I won't play this because I have the choice. Great privilege to have. I'm certainly not complaining about this. But does, of course, mean that you're going to have some difficult decisions at some point, right?
Yeah.
Do I play the World Cup? Do I play the Grand Chess Tour here? Mm-hmm. Do I play the Champion Chess Tour there? Do I play the Fischer Random here? It's going to be a lot of tournaments and some choices will have to be made. Because what I've noticed is the organizers, they have enthusiasm for chess. What they don't have any enthusiasm for is scheduling their tournaments around other tournaments. Sometimes they have to, because
that's an interesting point. Yeah.
Yeah, chess organizers do not like to compromise or to change their plans based on others. But sometimes they have to, because someone wants to play two tournaments and they don't want to risk that they lose, let's say, Magnus or someone like that, right? The other thing which is kind of important for this organizer is that, like, traditionally, mm-hmm. Let's say with FIDE, you have a lot of money coming from certain countries. And there's a lot of political division as well, right?
Yes.
And so some people will certainly be happy to see a sponsor from a Western country, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. which everyone will have a different view on this.
I've seen that point raised by a lot of people online, even I think, not to single anybody out, but I think Jacob Agard recently talked about it. He said that he doesn't necessarily like the fact that Magnus gets to choose a lot of things, and that Hikaru, as the reigning world chess 960 champion, did not participate in it. But still, you know, having the possibility to let's say outsource some income from a Westerner sponsor's perspective, he welcomes that. So I've seen that point raised by a few pundits, let's say.
Yeah, you know, I have like a very complicated relationship with this whole concept of like where sponsorship money comes from, because, you know, we played during the days also where sponsorship money came from very dirty places, and we didn't really talk much about it because and also going back before I was even playing these tournaments, right? Money coming from some really, really, really shady places. And now, of course, there's always political discussion about it, but there was also time when people were completely silent. So there's that element of, people talk about what they want to talk about, but they might have ignored similar situations in the past.
Yeah.
And And yeah, definitely. Like I've certainly played in tournaments where I don't know where the money is coming from, and if I had to guess, probably not from the most palatable place.
Well, I think that's a byproduct of the whole landscape of media changing overall, yeah, with social media and pretty much anybody being able to comment in real time on these type of things. And yeah, there's a volatility that comes with that, I guess.
Yeah, it's a complicated subject for sure. But I understand that for some people, of course, it's something that they're happy about.
Yeah.
That's what I've noticed. The online kind of discussion has been very positive for also for that reason. Like that was one of the reasons that there was a lot of positivity. And there's been negativity towards other sponsorship coming from different places that people are that's maybe a bit more politically divisive. Divisive. People are probably going to...
It's like finance and finance, yeah? Divisive, divisive. I think you can say it both
is it,
ways.
Is it?
I think you can say it both ways.
You can? Okay.
I think so, and that's coming from a... Romanian by origins. But
well, if I pronounce it incorrectly, then people will definitely point that out.
I mean, I usually say finance, and I'm hearing people in finance saying, no, it's finance.
Finance?
I think so. I think that's how they say finance. Something like that. Maybe. Anyway, point being, I think you can say it both ways. English is a complicated, complex language.
But in general, it's good, of course. I mean, I like the format. I think it's fresh. We can only say that overall, it's a positive thing.
Yeah.
That has happened.
Yeah. No. Again, everything looked really good. Tomorrow we have a tournament. We're going to play a tournament together.
Oh, yeah.
This might be the first time. Well, actually, it is the first time that we're playing a tournament together. Played against each other. Played in other formats, but not together on the same team. So this should be interesting. Team Chess, organized by chess.com. New format, Team Battle Chess. Basically, I think the format is two-player teams able to communicate with each other. The players are able to communicate with each other. A high-rated player, a lower-rated player, and the lower-rated player has the mouse, so controls, let's say, the mechanics of the game. You can talk with your teammate. You cannot hear whatever the other team is discussing, and basically that's the format. All in all, should be interesting. I had some doubts about it. I had some questions about it. Like, okay, I mean, I don't want to sound defeating in some regard, but, you know, obviously you're going to make most of the decisions in our team. I would assume in the team that we're facing Anish and Danny Wrench, Anish is probably going to make most of the decisions going up until, let's say, the final moments of the game. The time scrambles of the games in which the player doing the mechanical work will probably have a say. How do you see the dynamic playing out?
To be honest, I don't know. I think that I'm not going to, like, I'll give input, but I'm not going to tell you, like, I think this is a move that you must play. Because I think
no,
one
we're discussing,
might,
right? We're discussing.
Yeah. I think that the only way to get a really big advantage out of this is to discuss. Yeah, because there's going to be, like, sometimes you have tunnel vision, right? There's some things that I'm going to see that are, maybe I'm like not seeing the full picture, and then if you say something, then I'll maybe like be able to see the full picture a bit better, and. Like I noticed discussion definitely helps. I even played a game, like casual blitz game, against Levon plus Jordan. And they discussed, like, it was supposed to be basically like I played myself and they alternate moves.
Okay.
But instead what happened was they just discussed every move. And that is super helpful. It really does make someone play much better if
but
they
you
can
are
actually discuss.
Also hearing their discussion, right?
Well, okay, but it's more distracting for me because I have to make my moves on my own, and they're just discussing the position when they have to play, right?
They were not discussing on your move. They were not. You were not really thinking about what.
Well, they're not
saying.
Giving me advice. They're giving themselves advice.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
It's I've noticed that it is just very helpful because it's no longer like you feel pressure. It's like you, rather than having the pressure like you're going into something and you're alone, suddenly you just talk it out with someone, and it takes away all of the
you're sharing the responsibility a little bit.
Yeah, it sort of takes away like the sportive part of it where you're supposed to be on your own and you take these responsible decisions. And part of that is a challenge that you're responsible for every decision, every move. But if you can discuss things, like I say something and you're like, oh, wait, but what about this? And then I'm like, oh, well, actually, that's a good point. And it's just overall it makes it easier. It just makes it easier to play. So I think that's the discussion is going to be the deciding factor in these matches. Who can discuss better? Who can, who can communicate better?
At the same time, it can also play, this type of discussion can also play into, let's say, the accuracy of a decision. Maybe I convince you of playing something and down the line we realize that it was the wrong decision. Or, maybe Danny convinces Anish, just to give an example from a different team, of something that's not accurate down the road. And it doesn't have to be, let's say, a tactical thing. It can also be just a misunderstanding of the position by one of the players. So you still have to juggle this type of decision-making process.
Yeah, I think what will be important is that at some point we'll get into time trouble. And at that moment, it's important probably for you not to ever be in a panic mode.
Mm.
Because you'll always have 10 seconds of thinking time.
Mm-hmm.
And like if you're going for a move which is an obvious blunder, I can always, I can be like the blunder check, right? So we'll probably be mostly following your intuition. But if you're going for something that's like a very obvious mistake, I'll be like the blunder check in the background.
How would I tell you, though, that I'm thinking of making the move? Like, we should probably decide on that. Let's say we have 15 seconds, right?
It's basically the way that I think that you do it is that you just talk as if you're streaming. Mm-hmm. You're just going through your thought process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'll be thinking about the position. And if I notice something that I feel is really off in your thought process, then I can interject.
And I think we should also make sure that we're thinking and discussing very much on their time as well, especially as we go into those last few seconds. Like I make the move, I gain the time, and now it's their turn to make the move. And they still have, let's say, 20 seconds on the clock. Those 5 to 10 seconds that they're thinking about their move, we should maximize in terms of communication.
Yeah, we can use their time as well to our advantage.
Yeah.
But we'll see how it goes. I don't know. I haven't done this before in like a serious way. And okay, the thing is, I think that with all due respect, Danny, Danny's a friend. He's a weak link.
Oh my goodness.
He's a weak link in this match. I mean, look, I think that Anish, he might ruin it himself, but Danny is a weak link for sure.
Anish is in great shape. I mean, Anish just won the title Tuesday, his first title Tuesday, while streaming. I mean, it's...
Okay, but now there's recession to the mean. So he had a huge success.
Okay.
He's feeling very high.
On top
he's
of the
on
world.
Top of the world. Uh-huh. And now it's all going to... It's going down. It's all going very downhill for my good friend Anish Giri, AG as he calls himself.
AG1.
Did you watch his stream? I think it was a great stream. I really enjoyed watching it.
I did not watch his stream. I have to say I had other things, more productive things to do. But I did hear good things about it. And, I did go through the last couple of minutes of his last game. He seemed very happy, very joyous, enjoying the laurels of winning his first title Tuesday. It definitely felt like a happy stream. Let's just put it that way. It was a happy stream.
Yeah, he certainly was happy.
We have to tone him down tomorrow. We have to put him down tomorrow.
Put him down. Oh.
Well,
it's a strong word, but
we need to eliminate them from the competition. So I guess you can say that, put them down.
Is it a single elimination or a double elimination?
I think it's a single elimination. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Two game mini match, 10 plus 10. Us versus Anish and Danny, the CEO and CCO of chess.com.
Yeah, it's an interesting, you know, the other teams are also quite interesting, I have to say. By the way, I say interesting in like the normal way, not in a new way. Like the bracket, if you've seen it. So the other teams are Jordan Van Forest, Eric Hansen, mm-hmm. Hikaru Nakamura, Levi Rosman. They're playing a match as well.
That's the content team.
Yeah, and the chess bra team, right?
I don't know. Is Jordan a chess bra?
Yeah, I think so.
But I'm actually curious. Why is Amon not playing?
Okay, because they probably thought Eric and Amon would not be strong enough. Although I think that Jordan and Eric is pretty tough. They're both very good players.
It's a great team. It's a great team for
probably
sure.
Like they do average rating or something, and. Yeah, the thing is, like, I don't think my rating being whatever, however many points over Jordan's is like, it's not like that's a real difference. I think that the, like, Eric is a really strong second player.
Oh, yeah. I mean, compared to like both of them, they're maybe not the same level in classical chess, or at least not according to the ratings, but Eric is a very good blitz, rapid player for sure.
Sure. Yeah, he's a very, very good player. Rapid as well. And then you have Hikaru and Levi. Again, with all due respect to Levi, but he's a good blitz player. He's better relatively at blitz than his classical rating would suggest.
Much better, I would say. Yes.
Yeah.
Much better.
So he's still a good player, but I think that this team will also be a bit shaky. I don't know how that will go. Mm-hmm. Then another very dangerous team, I think, Robert Hess, Daniel Naroditsky. Because mm-hmm. Dania is a really good player. Mm-hmm. And I also think he might have like a excellent kind of feel for these things as well. I don't know. I mean, that's just speculation, but he might have an excellent feel for like how to play team chess. Mm-hmm. And Robert's a really good blitz player. He's like 2900 chess.com. So,
well, I mean, Dania is what, 3100, 3200 on a good day. So obviously a player with a lot of experience. Robert as well. Also Peter and Jan. That's a very decent team as well.
You know, I don't think that's... I think that Dania and Robert will beat them.
Really?
I really
okay.
do.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And then Peter Lecko and Pia Kramling versus Wesley and Alice.
Yeah, I don't know. This is hard to judge. I think maybe Peter and Pia could surprise us. Mm-hmm. Because they might be considered an underdog. But, you know, they're both really... I mean, obviously, Peter was a very, very top player who played a world championship match. And Pia is one of the greatest women players of all time, for sure.
Yeah.
No doubt. She's still like top 50, which is amazing because she's, you know, obviously she's far older than many of the other top players in the world, right? So she's competing with players who are much, much her junior.
Yeah.
And she's 32 in the world currently, mm-hmm. which is really remarkable for someone who like maybe isn't fully a professional player anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
And,
very, very
good. Yeah, so that's a good team. But I don't know. It's hard to say because a lot of it is communication. And the same with Wesley and Alice, I think... also, like, can they communicate is a question, but it could be a really good team. It might not work out. It might work out very well. Hard to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, definitely looking forward to it. I'm very excited about the tournament. Should be fun. Should be an interesting battle against the boys. Danny and Anish. Looking forward to it. What else has been happening? I think that covers, the most important, let's say, subjects of the week. We still have some time before the American Cup, and I'm sure we're going to tackle that discussion at some point in the next episode, and all the other things that are happening. One last thing that I really wanted to talk to you. We always talk about it, but I just saw this on Reddit, and it was mind-blowing to me. So top juniors, classical feeder ratings from February 2021. This was exactly 3 years ago. In number one, Alireza Firouzja, 27.59. Okay, understandable, 17 years of age. Abdusatorov, Nihal, and Pragnananda in second and third and fourth position. The only players, the only junior players at that point in time to be over 2,600. Keep that in mind. Now, if you go fast forward 3 years to present day, you have Gukesh, 2700, 2747, Pragnananda, 2747, Abdusatorov, 2744, Kaimur, 2738, and Sindarov, 2701. So you have five players that are over 2700.
Wait, let me get this right. So in 3 years ago, there were only how many players over 2600 in the junior list?
Three players.
Is that real? That doesn't. How can that be?
Because that's what I'm saying. Yes.
How can that be? No.
So Firouzja over 2700.
No. This was because of inactivity from COVID. I'm sure.
Maybe.
No.
Yes.
Because look, I
but
remember
it's crazy. The discrepancy is crazy, isn't it?
I don't think so, because like we have of course now a lot of these players they reach 2740s, but that was inactivity due to COVID. Because I can tell you. Like my generation, I first broke 2600 in 2007, end of 2007. So I was like 15. And I think I was a late bloomer compared to like, if you look at Wei Yi, if you look at Magnus, if you look at maybe Karjakin, if you look at, who else? Okay, I wasn't like a super late bloomer, but some of these. Like if you look at, I don't know, Negi, for example, I think he broke 2600 at like 14.
Yes.
So it can't be that like specifically that time period was so unusual that players weren't reaching 2600. I think it was just inactivity. Players weren't on the list due to COVID, or they just weren't playing because of COVID.
Could very much.
That's an outlier for sure. It's
Yeah, that was February 2021. So that was basically 1 year during COVID, right? So 2020 more or less stolen away from COVID.
I don't think it's so different these days than if we go back. Like, let me try to think. Okay, so Magnus, he became 2700 at which age? Was it 16?
I'll tell you in a second. How old is he now? 33, yeah?
He was born in 1990, December
He's
something.
33. So in 2007, he was what?
November
17?
30th, sorry.
In 2007, he was more or less 17, right? Or 18.
Wait, no, 2007, he would be, but which month he would be 17 or 16?
Okay, so at age 16, he broke 2700.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I broke 2700 in 2009 or 10. I think 2010, maybe 9 on the live list. So I would have been 17.
Okay, question
so
for
I was,
you.
I was a bit older than him. I was a bit more late compared to him, which is natural. Let's look at Anish, for example.
But I have a question for you before that. So Magnus broke 2700, 2710 in July 2007. And at that time, he was the number two junior in the world. Do you know who was number one?
Rajabov.
2007. Rajabov. Okay. I actually don't know the answer.
You saw that he was...
Says that he was number two. So I don't know exactly. I'm going to do my research later on today and maybe people can point it in the comments who was number one.
Because Rajabov was born in, I think, 87. So he would have been around the right age to still be a junior. And
19
be...
or 20, yes.
Yeah, so Rajabov would be a very natural pick, but other players, it could be Hikaru. That's the only other thing I could think of.
Okay,
That's but cool. I would actually guess that Hikaru was a bit of a late bloomer compared to like Rajabov. So I would guess Rajabov.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. And then it only, so already 2 months later, actually, no, not 2 months later, in January 2008, when he was 17, he was already number one junior at 27.33. So
yeah. Let's look, like, when did Anish become 2700 for the first time? So let me see. Rating.
Anish, so, I'll tell you.
27. It looks like he first broke it in July 2011, and he was born in 94. So correct. 17 as well.
17 also, yeah.
16, 17.
He was 17. He was 17.
Okay.
He was 17, so, and he was number three junior at that time.
If you look at like my generation, I would consider like Anish a bit younger than me, but my generation. Magnus a bit older, but my generation, it's all 16, 17, and in case of like Wei Yi, 15, mm-hmm. very early. Mm-hmm. So, of course, the current crop of juniors, they're extraordinary, but I don't think it's like a new thing entirely that like 18, 19, 17-year-olds are 27 something. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like, it seems I think
accurate, yes.
I think it's more or less on par with what we can expect from the best talent in the world, like Gukesh, Prague, Noderbeck, Keimer, Sindarov. The interesting thing is that the youngest is the number one, Gukesh. He's mm-hmm. the youngest, and he's also the, well, number one is a bit funny to say because he's tied with Prague,
but okay. Rating. Yeah.
They're the same rating, and he's a bit younger.
So, that was definitely the case in 2021. Alireza was by far like 27-63, and he was also the youngest, I think, or among the youngest, but by far number one.
Yeah, the interesting thing will be, like, there's some guys on this junior list who are a bit on the younger side, specifically Mishra and Maurizi, a bit on the younger side. Mm-hmm. Will they pick up the steam to get to, like, let's say, Gukesh, Prague, Noderbeck level, Keimer as well, obviously? Will they, like, keep up the, because you have to keep up the pace, right, to keep up with these talents.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Keep the pace.
But it's interesting. It's funny. A lot of these names, I've seen them for a long time, but they're still so young. Like Mirzin, I've seen him for forever, but he's only 17. So it's not like that's what the funny thing about Wei Yi, because everyone knew him as this almost top player at 15. Mm-hmm. And then because he didn't make enormous progress from 15 to like the age of 20, I don't know, 23, 24, mm-hmm. people started to think of him as like, kind
retired.
Of like over.
Retired.
Yeah, which is crazy. And then suddenly he became top 10 recently, and people remembered, oh, he's actually a really young guy. He's 24, right? He's not some retired player. He's actually a guy pretty much at his prime. So no reason to count him out of it's like sometimes our concept of like a professional career and when it might take off is a little bit maybe inaccurate, right? Like mm-hmm. also Duda, the guy's 25. Some people might think, oh, he's been on the scene so long that he's no longer one of those like talented youngsters. But okay, 25 is still quite a talented young player.
Yeah. I mean, Nepo didn't break through, you know, the crop of the crop until he was... what, 26, 27, something like that?
Yeah, I would say 27.
Let's say he's an exception, but still, it can definitely happen. You can definitely make that push from 2750 around that to like 2800, even in your late 20s.
Yeah, I agree with that for sure. He's a good example, but there's other good examples as well. Boris Gelfand, he played a world championship match in 2012. I think Boris was probably born in 1969. Let me check.
Let's see.
1968. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, he was
40,
not a super young player 40, when he 43. Played his.
Yeah.
Yeah, he wasn't a super young player when he played his first world championship match and almost won and almost became world champion, right? Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Anyway,
he actually reached his peak at that time, 2777, November 2013, or close to that time.
So, yeah, he was a top five player for quite a long time.
Yeah,
he was definitely a very, very great player. Yeah. But yeah, sometimes we forget because there are so many great players that it's easy to forget about all of their achievements.
And a very successful real estate agent as well.
Okay, people will not get that joke. There's no, it's too meta. There's no way.
Okay, follow.
He's not actually a real estate agent. I just want to explain that.
Follow Fabi's Twitter if you want to know more. Okay, I think that's ends our episode. Fabi, I'll see you tomorrow. We'll see everybody. Probably this episode, hopefully, is going to air before the match. So see you all on chess.com. Follow the match, support us, and hopefully we'll make it through. But definitely going to be a fun one. Cheers, guys. Bye.